I'm Artie Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show where we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's edition, we'll revisit a conversation I had with culinary explorer Anthony Bourdain. He joined me many years ago before his well-documented travels to discuss the ugly truths about the American restaurant industry. We'll also hear from New York Times wine critic Eric Asimov about how the wine neophyte can begin to enjoy and understand wines of all kinds. But first, Teller speaks. We'll hear a portion of my conversation with Teller, half of the duo Penn and Teller, who joined me in studio to discuss his life growing up in Philadelphia and how he became, of all things, a professional magician. That's all on Radio Times in Review, coming up after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks for joining us. First up on today's show, we'll listen back to my 2001 conversation with Teller, the quieter half of the comedy magic duo Penn and Teller. He broke his silence to join us on Radio Times to discuss his book, When I'm Dead, All This Will Be Yours. It was a tribute to his eccentric father and an examination of his time growing up in Philadelphia. Let's listen. Does it break some of the mystery, I guess, the mystery about Teller to have you here talking with us on the radio?
I don't know, does it?
But is that something you had to think about? I mean, have you protected your voice from prying journalists?
Not very much. It seems like the best thing about not talking on stage is that it's a joke that all of our fans can enjoy. I remember walking through Times Square one evening, and there were two cops standing there. And one stuck out his nightstick and stopped me, you know, put it right up against my chest and said, "Name?" And I said, "Teller." And he said, "Eh, I knew I could make him talk," nudged his partner there. So it's just this nice little, when I'm walking through malls, sometimes people will come up to me and say, "Excuse me, sir, what time is it?" And I'll say, 11:30. And I'll say, "He talked, I made him talk." You know? And that's kind of just their way of saying, "I know what you do for a living."
Well, one of the things I was reading in about you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, which is that you were kind of fascinated by the idea of, quote, lying without speaking, and that there was something about... and certainly Penn and Teller is in a sense, all about lying, done in a very entertaining way. But did that interest you, this idea of lying without saying a word?
I suffered through, you know, I started getting interested in magic when I was a tiny kid. I got some kind of heart ailment when I was a little kid and was bedridden for a long time and sat around watching Howdy Doody. And Howdy Doody offered a magic set. And for some reason, that took hold of me as a sort of psychological bedrock. And the thing that kept troubling me was that when magicians would talk on stage, it would always be things like, "Here I have a red ball." Or, you know, they'd invite audience members up and say insulting things about their attire or their physiques.
Right.
And this was exceedingly repulsive to me. And I thought maybe it would be a good idea to come up with a way of delivering the ideas that I wanted to deliver in such a way that the public could just look at them and figure out what was going on, watch what was going on, get the information through their eyes and through the plot and through the story. And so when I was in college, I was a very pretentious college student, you know, as what college student is not pretentious?
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, right. And so I conned a professor into doing what they called a reading course, a one-on-one course with me, which we called the Figure of the Magician in Dramatic Literature.
Sounds like an Ivy League education.
Isn't that
to
something,
me?
Though? You know, we didn't do any dramatic literature. We just sat around and worked on my magic act. And one of the things I tried there was I thought, well, okay, let's try this dead silence. Let's not add the words to explain it, and let's not even use music to fill it with emotion that it doesn't actually have. You know, you'll often see people on stage doing magic, and they'll pipe in like 1960s music that captures some emotion that has nothing to do with the trick, you know. But I just thought, that actually, honestly, rather nakedly exposing the idea was pretty interesting. And of course, when I met Penn, he had been dealing with, rough audiences and getting his ideas across by being as verbal as possible. And, you know, he talks in fire.
Yes, he does.
For whatever virtues my speech has, it's not fire. It's prose. I'm a prosy guy. Penn is a fiery guy. And when he talks, it's really something worth listening to. So the two things melded together very nicely.
I heard one way to get a rise out of Teller is to say that to make the comparison between you and someone that does mime. Is that true? Is that an insult to what you do?
I find mime sets my teeth on edge because, first, people smear white gunk all over their faces, and then they do things that don't feel real. They feel really fake. And I have a very strong need when I go to a show to feel like there's something very real under it, whether it's the passions of the people. I mean, like in our current live show,
right,
we're doing a flag-burning piece, and it's all about how patriotic we became last year when we were abroad in Egypt, India, and China, and saw what it's like to live in countries without freedom. And so this is a piece that calls itself flag-burning, but ends up being more flag-wavingly patriotic than George
shocked.
M. Cohan.
I am shocked.
No, it really is true, because we place the flag, folding it with white gloves. We place it in a rolled copy of the Bill of Rights and hold a lighter underneath, and there's a flash of fireworks. And this is, a pretty direct metaphor to talk about how the flag itself is just a symbol and is protected by the Bill of Rights.
I wonder, too, about this howdy-doody magic set that you got back when you were 5 or 6 years old. What was in that?
It was flat. That's what I remember. It was entirely flat. It came in an 8.5 by 11 manila envelope, and you pulled out these little cardboard pieces and punched them out with the little, the little perforations. Then you fitted them together. And the only trick I remember from it is there was a coin multiplication tray. You snuck a couple of pennies between two layers of fake tray, then you put a few pennies on top, and when you dumped the pennies off, the secret ones from inside would be added, and you'd have more money. A great miracle for a 5-year-old.
Absolutely. Absolutely. you went to Central High School in Philadelphia,
yeah.
and you've written about an English teacher, I guess, and a drama coach, a guy named Rosie Rosenbaum.
David G. Rosenbaum, who was my high school English teacher, a brilliant high school English teacher. I mean, just one of those inspiring teachers, life-changing teachers, who was also a drama coach and a superb actor and a really great, bold director, who would do things like, he would sell the high school on the idea that we should be doing Oedipus Rex in evening clothes in the high school auditorium, with Oedipus delivering his address to the people of Thebes from the principal's lectern, right? And he would there were people in that audience crying, as they should at a tragedy, with these little high school kids doing it. He was incredibly brave, one of those life-changing brave teachers. And he also happened to be a magician and had been a magician since he was a teenager. And so he and I spent many, many, many Saturdays sitting in his apartment, which was liberally decorated with black candles and skulls, and talking about the defects of magic, which really basically come down to the fact that in much of magical performance, the audience is not respected. The audience, the intelligence
there's
of the audience.
There's something hostile about it, right?
Yeah, and the magician treats the audience as though, because he can do a few tricks, all those people out in the audience who can, do brain surgery and fix cars are dolts. And that's really not what it's about at all.
But people like David Copperfield get to go date, leggy women with blonde hair half their age. I mean, there are certain perks that this society gives to magicians.
At least as far as the magazine cover photos tell us, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That has never come your way?
Not that I would put on a magazine cover.
You're more discreet than that.
I'm a person who really does believe that a human being needs a private life and a public life. And I really think that having a private life is a valuable thing. It's a refuge. Because I always think that when you're talking about the press and private life, it's like if you say, come to my wedding, you're also inviting the press to your divorce.
Right.
It's sort of like the old myth of once you invite the vampire over the threshold, you can never get rid of him.
Both your mother and your father, who live here in Philadelphia, both of whom are artists.
My father had been an art student for about 10 years, and he decided he was going to become a cartoonist. And so he realized that cartoonists have to turn out a cartoon a day. And he said, okay, I will do this. I will discipline myself to do this. And he was working as a copy boy at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mm. And he every afternoon when he was done with his part-time job, he would go out and walk the streets of Philadelphia and observe. He wouldn't make sketches. He'd just mentally record all of these things. And then at the end of the day, he'd go home and he'd draw a cartoon. And he did this for the better part of a year. And I knew nothing about these cartoons.
I was so surprised to hear that.
It's amazing. I knew my parents were artists. They have a studio on the top floor of their house, and they go up and paint every day. And I knew that they were artists. I knew that my father had earned his living as a commercial artist, doing lettering for newspapers back before computer typography came into place. But I had no idea there were cartoons. And I was sitting in the living room one day, and I was reading the Philadelphia Inquirer. My father said, "You ever see my cartoons?" Well, I said, "No." So we went up, we trudged up the, you know, 3.5 flights of stairs, and dug out this just grimy, decaying portfolio, opened it up, and in it were about 100 or so of these just beautiful, wonderful period cartoons that in 1939... he had tried to sell to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and my mother was his agent. She marched in there. She carried the cartoons under her arm, marched in there up to the editor, who said, "Geez, these are terrific, but we got no room for a new cartoon on the page." And so, you know, my father, being a practical person, you know, in those days, we're talking just post-Depression. In those days, people had a more practical attitude towards things. Okay, we can't sell the cartoons. Let's do something else.
It's clear where some of your humor came from, and I assume from both your mother and your father.
They're both pretty funny people. My mother won't own up to being funny, but she has a very, very dry way about her that's really, really quite funny.
One thing that I read, Teller, that you said about teaching, that the first 3 years are absolute, pure, unmitigated hell. Is that true?
Well, yes. When you're a teacher, what you're doing is you're placing yourself in front of the most frank audience of people you will ever meet. You know, adults will be you know, deferential to you. Kids will show you by their actions exactly who you are. And this is a painful revelation, particularly if you grew up as an only child. And also the burden of work, the amount of work the teachers do. If you're just, you know, a parent or a student or, you know, somebody who observes from afar, you have no idea. You are seeing just the tip of the iceberg. When the teacher merrily walks into the classroom prepared, there are just hours behind that. And every time there's a test or a quiz or an assignment, there's 2 hours that this teacher's been sitting at home. And the burden of work is staggering. Yeah. And the first 3 years, you're becoming acquainted with, you know, how to approach this sort of epic task.
And does being a Latin teacher make you a stickler for the English language? Are you offended by dangling participles and split infinitives and things like that?
I am, but I was before I was a Latin teacher. That may have been, you know, part of what drove me to be a Latin teacher. Yeah, I don't like imprecision of speech. I really don't. And I don't think it's good for the culture. And it's being accepted more and more and more. You see things in print that are full of, you know, hard to understand sentences. And that troubles me.
That was my conversation with Teller, the silent partner in the comedy magic duo Penn and Teller, recorded back in 2001. Their show is currently in the midst of a 6-week run on Broadway. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about wine and how best to enjoy it when we hear my conversation with Eric Asimov, wine and food critic for the New York Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Ever had the urge to develop a taste for the finer things? Whether it's books or movies, music, food, or wine, the amateur enthusiast can feel overwhelmed by the idea of becoming a cultural expert. There are real money and time barriers. There's also the feeling that you might not know what the heck you're talking about. Well, Eric Asimov is aware of these insecurities. He joined us a couple of years ago following the publication of his book, How to Love Wine, a memoir and manifesto. The book is an entree into the wine world and encourages readers to trust their palates. Let's take a listen.
It's a very subjective world that you live in. Yes? Evaluating wines, describing wines, giving them, you know, numbers.
Yes. I mean, to a point, they're, and this is always a great debate no matter what field you're in. I mean, there is a standard of excellence that there's a lot of agreement on. But then when you depart slightly from that or explain why, that's where the subjectivity comes in.
Do you have to have an arsenal of adjectives to be a wine critic?
It seems that way, doesn't it?
It does.
But, you know, to me, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I kept noticing people talking to me and telling me how they felt they didn't have what it takes to understand wine. They wanted to like it, but maybe they lacked the right equipment because all of the aromas and flavors that people keep talking about, they just didn't get. And it occurred to me that might be the problem, the way we talk about wine, think about wine, educate people about wine. That might be contributing to some of the discomfort that people were feeling about wine.
Do you think wine then is indescribable?
Oh, not at all. You can definitely describe it. I think, though, that the practice of tasting notes, describing these obscure esoteric aromas and flavors that has really become the vocabulary for discussing wine is counterproductive. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good to know that this wine tastes like boysenberry and this wine tastes like raspberry and the third wine tastes like a certain kind of tobacco that nobody's ever experienced. It's to me, the farther down you go in being specific in trying to describe flavors, more testimony to ego and creativity than it is to actual communication.
You think that's kind of show-off-y? I mean, to come up with those analogies?
I'm not sure that people think of it that way, although there's definitely a competitive urge to be more precise than the next person. But it's most definitely counterproductive because it not only doesn't communicate anything about the general character of a wine or the experience of drinking it, it ignores very important elements that go into the experience of wine, like context, food, people, mood, weather, all of
lighting,
which have an important effect. Lighting, absolutely.
What do you think of blind tastings? I think I know what you're going to say, but say it anyway.
Well, blind tastings are useful as a self-educational tool, but they are wrong as a means of as a sole means of judging wines because it reduces wine to sort of an object for consumer reports, like comparing toasters or cars or something like that. And really good wine, it comes from a place. It's made by people who often have been making these wines for centuries. And there's an expression of culture in really good wines that must be accounted for. And when you sort of sever wine from its origins and from any sort of context and just examine it under a fluorescent light in an operating theater, I think it does a disservice to the wine.
You do it, though, do you not? I mean, is that part of your job?
It is. And I'm not completely consistent on this. It seems to be an accepted way of analyzing wines. And as I said, for me personally, it's educational and a challenge. But I have to, in writing, sometimes account for the what has occurred in a blind tasting situation and try to explain it anyway, because I don't believe that, you know, the results in a blind tasting cut through any sort of prejudice and show the truth.
How important is it to have a right shaped glass for wine, to smell it, to swirl it, to sip it? I mean, are there ways to drink wine you think that where you get the most experience, taste experience?
Well, I think good glasses are important, but we take that to absurd extremes. I mean, you know, companies design different glasses for every possible variation on a wine. You've got your Oregon Pinot Noir glass and your Santa Barbara Pinot Noir glass, and it's, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's crazy. But a good wine glass that's generally taller than it is wide and has a kind of a tuliped top to it, those can be very helpful. And they feel good in the hand. There's something sensually pleasing about a good wine glass.
Do you miss something if you drink it out of a jelly glass?
You know something? I think that for years, that's how people have consumed wines. Mm-hmm. And some wines are perfectly appropriate to drink in those sorts of glasses. And you're not going to – you might lose – part of the experience, but it's not ruined.
What's the most expensive bottle of wine you've ever drunk?
Priceless. I had a bottle of, well, the oldest wine I ever had, in 1846 Merceau.
Oh, wow.
Consumed in Burgundy at Bouchard Père et Fils, the producer. So, you know, that's not a wine that you obviously you can go buy anywhere. And, you know, part of my challenge and my joy is to communicate the experience of a wine like that for vicarious pleasure rather than like, you know, lucky me, I got to drink it and you didn't.
What did it taste like?
Well, for one thing, it was surprisingly fresh. And, you know, alive for a wine that was 160 years old at the time. And, you know, I said it could have been 100 years younger.
You also write about that, and perhaps this is where we're headed here, but there seems to be a fair amount of, and I'm using your words here, fears and inhibition about wine. And perhaps it's because there's so much to choose from. And oftentimes you feel like you have to be an expert or you have to know what it is that you're buying or you're ordering. Should we be fearful and inhibited about our wine drinking?
Well, absolutely not. Although I completely understand the feeling. First of all, you know, it's an arcane subject. There's a lot to learn and a lot to memorize. And I think we've been communicated a false message by books that one volume that purports to teach us everything we need to know to never order the wrong bottle again, how not to embarrass yourself in front of your boss, you know, that sort of thing. No, it's like if you want to learn how to play golf, you don't watch one video and read one book. You've got to do it for years and years.
So try it, taste things,
yeah.
See what they taste like.
But I think, you know, more than that, we've got a culture that describes things in these sort of esoteric tasting notes that don't square with our own experience. And a lot of people think, oh, there must be something wrong with me then.
Because I don't taste the raspberry or
right,
something like
exactly.
that.
And then there's the, you know, always the stereotype of the haughty sommelier who's going not only going to sneer at you but rip you off, and so you almost go into a restaurant and crouched in a defensive position, and
not you know, a good way to enjoy a meal.
No.
So do you suggest people? I mean, as you say, find a good wine store. Now we are in Pennsylvania, and
yes.
We do have a state store system. Not that some of them aren't good, but nonetheless, that's a whole other world. But you say, you know, find a wine store or liquor store where you feel like people know what they're talking about, and try things? I mean, buy a bottle, try it at home.
It's the best way and the easiest and most pleasurable way if you can find a good wine shop and meet somebody there and establish a relationship, a business relationship. And, you know, people who work in wine shops, good shops, are passionate about what they're doing. And they like nothing better than to turn you on to what they love. And when you establish a relationship like that, they become invested. Mm-hmm. And so I suggest, trying different wines. And you have to do a little work also if you want to learn. You have to keep notes and try to understand what it is you like and what it is you don't like. And then if this is something that captures you, and that's the time to start taking classes and reading books and things.
And would you say that American wines are as good as some of the wines you might drink in France or Germany or Spain? Or are they different? I mean, is there something different about American wine?
Well, there's definitely something different. I would say there are great American wines for sure. I think we have a much younger wine culture, so it's harder to find those sorts of wines of cultural expression that I was talking about before. We just don't have that that history, but they are out there, and I think right now you've got kind of a younger generation coming of age in California, in New York, Oregon, Washington, and so many other states, including Pennsylvania, that are seeing wine in a little bit different way than their who they learned from. And I feel very optimistic about American wines right now.
Well, and I've said this before on the air, my pet peeve are those oaky, buttery Chardonnays. I mean, there are many other kinds of Chardonnays, but I know that was kind of a rage for a while.
Well, you know, that was the style. That was the style of the 90s, and it got all sorts of critical acclaim. But this has been the kind of leading edge in the American wine revolution, where there was such a kind of a counter attack to those sorts of wines that people have been pulling back and making wines of much more restraint and elegance and subtlety. And I see now you start to see it in other areas, Cabernet and Pinot Noir, Syrah.
And does France still sort of hold this special place when it comes to wine? Just because of this long tradition, you've got vineyards that go back generations. There's just this knowledge about and tradition, culture of wine.
I don't think there's any way to deny that. France is the seat of great global winemaking. And if you look around the world, look in California, the wines that they're emulating there are all French wines. Now people are going their own way and carving out their own identities. But even more than that, France has such a tremendous diversity of wines. We can't hope to match that right now. And they have the tradition, which you see in other old world countries, but their sort of their global identity is a little bit less established than France's.
As you describe in your book, you're really a self-taught wine critic. You took a class, but you weren't particularly impressed. Would you say you're self-taught?
I absolutely. You know, there's an old saw in the wine business. The way to learn about wine is to pull corks. Plenty of them. And that was basically my approach. I was going to drink a lot of wine. And after a while, I started trying to pay attention to what I was drinking. And, you know, you have to have a lot of conversations with people and to try out things, explore different theories, pull back when necessary. But, I found that wine classes, they don't teach you how to love wine, for example. They teach you how to taste wine.
And that's different.
And I believe that's very different. And one of the theses of my book is that our culture conveys that in order to enjoy wine, you have to know everything about it first. You have to, in a sense, essentially become a connoisseur before you can simply enjoy wine. And my feeling is that equation is backwards. The first thing you want to do is establish an emotional connection to wine, fall in love with it, and then you're motivated to want to learn more about it, to be curious about it, not because you want it, not because it's a sense of obligation.
Do you also think, though, that humility, modesty is important for a wine critic or for any of us who enjoy a glass
of
wine?
Because we also have to remember that that wine is a mystery in a lot of ways. And you often hear the term demystifying wine. I don't believe in that at all. I believe in demystifying wine drinking. But wine itself, the mystery is part of the beauty of it. And I think that our wine culture is intended to eliminate the mystery, to boil it down to a set of aromas and flavors, to tell you how good it is on the 100-point scale, to tell you when to drink it and with what to drink it. And they want to ensure that they eliminate as far as they can any sort of chance that's involved. Mm-hmm. And for me, winemaking is all about surprise and beauty, or wine itself is all about surprise and beauty and mystery. And a wine importer, Terry Thies, coined the phrase remystifying wine, and I believe in that.
We started with your career as a beer critic for your high school newspaper. You also tasted the beer that's been grown at the White House.
Well,
Made at the White House, I should say.
Yes, and we created a facsimile of that. I still write about beer occasionally. I love beer, and we tried very hard to get an actual bottle of the White House beer, but they were not giving out any. So we got a local brewer, Brooklyn Brewery, to make a small batch according to the recipe used by the White House, and it was really good.
Really good meaning really good?
Really good, yes. I mean, of course, there's something wonderful about homemade beer, as all home brewers know. Yeah, you can make mistakes, but there's a freshness to it, and it's alive in a way that, you know, the more store-bought beers generally are not. They have other things going for them, but this vivid feeling was right there.
You just heard my conversation with New York Times food and wine critic Eric Asimov about his memoir and manifesto, How to Love Wine. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with Anthony Bourdain. He joined us years ago following the publication of his book, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We end today's show revisiting my conversation with culinary explorer Anthony Bourdain. He joined me before he had made two award-winning television series, the Travel Channel's No Reservations and CNN's Parts Unknown. These shows see him traveling the world and sampling local and sometimes unusual food and culture, and have made Bourdain a national celebrity. But it was his book, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, written more than a decade ago, that first got him national attention. It was an exploration of American restaurants and laid bare the less flattering aspects of the culture that surrounds the people who make our food and the places where we eat. Let's take a listen. So, Anthony Bourdain, I've been reading both your book and about your book. Have you gotten in trouble for writing this thing? Have you broken a kind of taboo?
You know, I don't think so. The most enthusiastic people about the book seem to be people in the business. And I've never had so many free drinks and free appetizers sent my way in my life. So apparently it's going over well in the industry.
Well, you write about the sort of world of the kitchen in this kind of militaristic terms. You use a kind of military lingo. Is that how you see it?
Well, Escoffier called it the brigade system, and for good reason. I mean, it is a rigid, centuries-old military hierarchy in there. It's a perfect mix, for me anyway, of order and chaos. And it's one of the things that's unique to the business, in fact, that you've got very disorganized people working in such an organized business.
Is that what do you think attracts people? And you do call them foodies, and I've worked in kitchens, so I know about the eccentrics there. Is there something about this sort of mix of order and chaos and drama?
I think so. I think it obviously speaks to some, you know, dark part of my soul. I had a very chaotic life outside of the restaurant business, and I did find it is the orderly, organized, certain part of my life now, and it fills an important place in it.
And you write, Anthony, about the artists, the mercenaries, and the exiles, I guess. These are the chefs.
Yeah.
Who are these people?
Well, artists, I would put them at the bottom of the list as far as what I'm looking for in an employee. I'm looking exactly for the type of person who won't crack under pressure, who could be dependent on to show up on time. So your exiles and your mercenaries are more attractive to me in as far as employees go. Artists are high maintenance.
And perhaps if the job is to get a meal out in a timely way, you don't want artists doing their artist thing, right?
I mean, that's you must have the food up on time correctly every day, day in, day out. And, that's the bottom line.
Are chefs born or made?
They're made. I think there's certain, there might be personality types who could never be chefs or even cooks or work in the business. But with a few exceptions, I don't think there are many, people born to be great chefs or even chefs. I think it's just something that, happens.
Well, you talk about the sort of choreography of line cooking. And for folks that have not been inside a restaurant kitchen, what does line cooking look like? How does that work?
Well, it's a number of stations depending on how big the restaurant is and how big the menu. One guy is doing the grilling and or broiling. There's generally a saute station, frequently a middle station, someone who plates vegetables, side dishes, things like that, a cold station, sometimes pastry, dessert. And all of these people are presumably coming up with their various components of the meal at the same time and then getting it out to the right table in the right position and then doing it over again and again. And so a lot of rather graceful movement is required, very quick graceful movement and requiring a lot of economy, too. You don't want to do a lot of spinning around, the wasted effort, wasted movement. It's a really extraordinary thing to watch.
And as an executive chef, where are you? Are you at the head of the line there?
If not cooking on the line myself, I'm generally expediting, which is sort of like being an air traffic controller, drill sergeant, father confessor, cop.
A lot of screaming in the kitchen, right? Or a lot of yelling, a lot of vocalizing.
There is a long tradition of a powerful oral tradition in the kitchen. Let's put it that way.
You even have a chapter in your book about the various... let's see, we can't say them on the radio, sort of creative language that's used in the kitchen and euphemisms for this, that, and the other,
That also, to me, the mix of sort of Mexican prison slang, the Spanglish, the sort of mutt dialect that we have, the patois, I find that beautiful as well. I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't, but...
But you like it. And can you tell a chef because of the scars and burns on their wrist?
To less and less an extent. But there's a callus here at the base of the index finger that communicates a lot of information. I mean, I don't know whether I mentioned in the book meeting Jean-Louis Paladin for the first time. I was, of course, naturally suspicious of him because he's a famous chef at the time, a number of operations. Boy, I shook his hand and felt like a field hands.
Really?
This was a guy who's... I mean, I knew instantly this is a guy who's worked a lot and for a long time. He's had had a tough time coming up.
But are you talking about just a slicing? I mean, getting
just,
that
that's where the heel, it's where the heel of the knife rests right here. Hmm. And then there's a smaller one where the back of the knife handle rests. And you can just tell a lot. It's one of those little sort of secret handshake things that the subculture enjoys.
I mean, and you also write about the sort of testosterone environment back there. You think that's one and the same?
It's sort of a faux testosterone thing because, I mean, we there's really very little – you can't have much pretense. There's a lot of bluster, a lot of hyperbole. Right. But, yeah, there's a sense you do not want to put your comrades in the weeds, you know, and going to the hospital being somebody else has got to cover you while you're getting stitched up.
But is there something about, you know, cutting yourself or burning yourself? And
I think as a defense mechanism, we've just learned over time to try to minimize it. You know, someone cuts himself badly, everyone else in the kitchen will make fun of him or slap him in the back and say, good one, you know, 10 points. because you don't want the guy, you know, go turning white and starting to pass out. Right. And so it's helpful in a strange way.
And you talk about the sort of hierarchy. And I mean, you certainly worked your way up as well.
Also started as a pot washer, dishwasher, right. and you know, looked over the line at, you know, this was the 70s, looked at what the chefs and cooks looked like. And, you know, back then they were pirate princes. And I said, wow, I want this.
Right. Do you ever have chef nightmares?
Yes, frequently.
How do they go?
Not being ready.
Okay.
There's the left something in the oven dream, left the fryer later on dream, and the just not being ready, you know, to suddenly moving in slow motion, unable to, you know, get the stuff up in time.
Right. Right.
My whole entire life is constructed around not letting any of those things come true.
Right. It's a sort of classic, didn't study for the test. Well, and I guess from my server days, the sort of equivalent one for a waiter or waitress is obviously getting too many tables all at once. You can't get the food out of the kitchen. I mean, sometimes this was actually true. It wasn't a nightmare. And then being naked totally on top of it as well, just to add to the humiliation. And I wonder, even from perhaps your experience working in various different restaurants, Anthony, whether there are restaurants that are cruel places to work, unhappy places to work. And perhaps...
Without question.
Yeah.
Sure. I would say a great number of them. And I think even the those among us who love their work and would never consider leaving it are miserable, you know, at least 40% of the time. I mean, it's the mood swings and the adrenaline production are half of the kick, is that it's sort of vacillating between utter misery and crazed sense of triumph. It's feels good somehow.
But the misery is about just the work. It's hard work. It's
the frustration, the pressure, the disappointment, the anticipation of disaster. You know, you have high expectations. Everybody's got to be up to par all the time. You want the whole world to operate the way your kitchen does, and of course it doesn't. It makes things, you know, it's why so many chefs are kind of dysfunctional outside of the kitchen. I know I am.
And I wonder, too, whether if there is a difficult boss or perhaps a difficult server, whether there are ways in the kitchen of getting revenge.
Yeah, of course. I mean, traditionally, the kitchen bullies the floor mercilessly during the shift. You know, hopefully, certainly in my kitchen, afterwards, we're all pals and buy beers for one another. But that's because there's this, I mean, it goes back, you know, even Orwell talks about the fact that, you know, the waiters make more money.
Yep.
And whole kind of lead a more exalted lifestyle than the cooks. So given the 2 or 3 hour service period, this is when the cooks get a chance to make they hold all the power because they can speed up or slow down the food, you know, bully the floor and, you know, that sort of nonsense.
Right. Well, I certainly remember being very nice to the chef, especially 8 o'clock on Saturday night. Well, it's interesting, this sort of microcosm of society all crammed into either a kitchen or a restaurant. I mean, that you have from the pot washer to the owner.
I think one of the really great things about the restaurant business is that it forces people under pressure to work together. You know, people from the mountains of Mexico, from inner cities, from every possible variety of human being forced together into a situation where they have to become, as John says, a family, a team. And it's one of the luxuries of the business is that you get to work with some really extraordinary people who you never would have met under ordinary circumstances.
You write about the number of Hispanic chefs, I mean, folks along the cook line there that never went to the Culinary Institute of America, the CIA, but could, cook their way out of any problem.
Best
right?
French and Italian cooks in New York are from Mexico and Ecuador.
Yeah. And you've seen it. You've observed it.
Yes.
What do they know? They just know? They watch? They've been there?
The American dream is alive in Mexico and Ecuador. Just it's a character issue to me. It's you know, these are people who came in as dishwashers, I think, like John and I did,
yeah.
and worked their way up the line, you know, right. who didn't look for school to get them someplace immediately.
Although you went to the CIA.
Yeah, I did, and I enjoyed it, and I think it's a good force in the business. But I think that immediately upon graduating from CIA, you should probably work as a dishwasher for 6 or 8 months.
Keep you humble? Yeah.
And it will really, you'll learn quickly, do I really want to be in the restaurant business? Right. And it's good to learn from the ground up like that. You understand the nuts and bolts of the business.
There's something you say, Anthony Bourdain, here, which these are fighting words. Mm. Vegetarians are the enemy of everything good and decent in the human spirit. Go ahead, defend yourself on NPR. You said that.
Well, I come from the French tradition. I was trained the French way. First thing I do when I come in the morning is roast veal bones. And for me, a demi-glace, reduced veal stock, is, you know, the perfect vessel of limitless possibilities. So that, of course, I'm going to be annoyed with vegetarians. They're asking me, in a sense, or they would have me, I think, in my moments of extremis, paint with only two colors out mm-hmm. of a full spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that there is a relationship between sense of humor and animal protein intake. this is a personal theory.
Yeah, I was going to say, and where's the evidence for that?
None at all.
None at all. I understand. But are you saying, in a sense, at your restaurant, vegetarians might as well go eat somewhere else?
Well, we have a meat counter, as soon as you walk in the door, filled with all sorts of hooves and snouts and sausages, mm-hmm. so they know they're in the heart of darkness when
okay.
they come in the door.
So
they're not coming.
They ain't coming. And Anthony, you say, at least for folks looking at a restaurant, if they can't keep the bathroom clean, chances are the kitchen's not clean.
I think the bathroom is a reflection of everything else, in a sense. You know, Thomas Keller talks about it. I just read a book where he explains why he's so good. And he tracks it all back to his mother making him clean the bathroom as a kid. Meaning, how scrupulous you are about cleanliness translates into everything else you do. And, you know, I think he's taken it perhaps to an extreme level. His food is, you know, unbelievably, fantastically detailed and difficult to prepare.
Oh, sure.
Been extraordinary. But I think a line cook who works clean, as we call it, is more likely to be an organized, mm-hmm. on-the-ball cook.
Mm-hmm. And by working clean, it's just making all your implements are clean and you are.
You work organized. There's not a lot of scraps and nonsense. Mm-hmm. Your station looks clean, is mm-hmm. clean, and that you're conscientious throughout. You have good work habits and that you're organized in your mind. So it's, the restaurant business is certainly cleaner, I think, than it has ever been.
Have you ever had a customer, I'm sure you have, had each of you a customer that you could just never satisfy? I mean, just kept sending
sure.
things back. And I mean, what do you do under those circumstances?
We,
is it just eventually show them the door or what?
We do everything we can and then just, you know, eat our own livers afterwards. You know, we swallow our rage and frustration and do the best we can. There's really no
customer's
percentage.
Always right. I mean, even
well,
if they're
we'd have to treat them that way even if they're dead wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the reasons why Marco Pierre White was such a cult hero among chefs for a while, as he was famous for throwing 86 customers out of his dining room in one night.
Everyone's going, yay!
Just one at a time. What are you looking at? You don't like it? You're out. And of course, he's extraordinarily successful. So that he could do it and get away with it is something that we all kind of secretly yearn for, but of course can't do.
Well, I hate to raise the question of food critics, but I mean, they can clearly make or break a restaurant,
mm-hmm.
And there's some good ones and there's some not so good ones. Do they know what they're talking about, do you think?
The ones that matter do. Mm-hmm. The ones who are straight, you know, who aren't coming to shake you down for a free meal.
And there's some of that?
There's a lot of that. A
lot of that.
Yeah,
so you give me a free meal and I'll give you a good review.
Oh, yeah. There are all sorts of little, you know, shopper news and even some of the big, you know, the glossies in New York. I mean, these guys are essentially, it's I don't know if it's organized crime, I'd call it that bad. But basically they come in, they announce themselves, they expect them and their friends to be taken care of. And then you get a puffy piece in return.
Hmm.
The product that results is not really important to the success or failure of your restaurant. Whereas the unimpeachably good ones, like, you know, the Times, that can make or break you.
Sure.
And, and we as chefs take their what they have to say about us very, very seriously.
Right. Again, that was my conversation with celebrity food explorer Anthony Bourdain. He joined me in 2000 following the release of his breakthrough book, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.